All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's JNEB Journal Club webinar. I'm glad to have you with us on this short holiday week. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB. And if you look down in your GoToWebinar toolbar, there'll be one handout. Our presenters have made the slides available to us, so if you want to download those, you can follow along during the presentation. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question box so we can moderate those to the presenters. Watch for a follow-up email from me on, I'll probably try and get it out by the end of the day tomorrow on Tuesday. So that'll include the link to the recording that we're making, the slide handout, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance. And when I close out the webinar today, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session. As always, ideas for future sessions are much appreciated also. Our moderator today is Virginia Quick. She's Assistant Research Professor at Rutgers University in the School of Environmental and Biological Sciences.
Great. And so thank you again for everyone coming and being able to hear a lovely talk today. I know we have two great speakers with us. One of them is Dr. Jerrica Burge. She is an Associate Professor and Behavioral Health Provider in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And her research focuses on risk and protective factors for childhood and adolescent obesity in the home environment. She conducts both childhood obesity prevention and treatment studies within primary care settings with the ultimate goal of decreasing childhood obesity disparities in low-income and minority households. Dr. Burge has expertise in conducting mixed method studies with multiple family members, and she utilizes observational methods such as ecological momentary assessment and video recorded family paths, as well as quantitative survey data to more fully understand these complex family dynamics and processes related to physical activity and dietary behaviors in children and adolescents. She's also one of the most cited authors on family dynamics and childhood obesity with over 100 publications, 300 presentations, and 20 book chapters on related topics. She also serves as a member of the Psychosocial Risk and Disease Prevention Studies section at NIH and several other special interest study sections. And with all those other wonderful acclamations that she has, she's a licensed marriage and family therapist and supervisor who specializes in integrated care to address family health issues. And she supervises both doctor-level behavioral health providers and medical residents in family medicine settings. We also have with us Amanda Trofowitz. She is a project director for multiple NIH-funded studies focusing on identifying key home environment factors that increase or minimize the risk for childhood obesity. And she currently oversees a study utilizing in-home visits and ecological momentary assessment to identify these home environment factors in racially, ethnically diverse homes. She is skilled in using mixed method designs and qualitative coding. And as a registered dietitian, she also oversees nutrition-related components of these studies, which includes the collection of the 24-hour dietary recalls. Her particular interest includes associations between family meals and child dietary intake and home food availability. And so it's a pleasure to have them both here today to talk with us about a qualitative investigation of parents' perspectives about feeding practices with siblings among racially, ethnically, and socioeconomically diverse households.
Thank you. We're excited to be here. I also wanted to thank SNEB for inviting us to do this journal club. And we're excited to talk a little bit about our mixed methods study here. So to begin, I wanted to give you a context or framework to understand where we're coming from and our interest here in our qualitative data. With siblings, there's a little bit of evidence around feeding practices and eating behaviors. So that is one of our reasons that we're driving this study. And to start with, we looked in the literature just to see how common it was to have a sibling. So over 65% of families have siblings in the household. And so it's a pretty common experience for most households. Well, so we also know that across the lifespan, siblings are the longest lasting relationships in terms of life expectancy, and so they may have the most sustained influence on children's eating behaviors into adulthood. So this area of interest for me is key because I look at relational influences, and siblings are one in which, again, the closeness in age can be one factor that influences a number of behaviors, but especially eating behaviors. So because of the limited research on siblings, and then in particular sibling eating behaviors, this study was particularly interesting to us. At the same time, parent feeding practices, there is little literature looking at feeding practices with siblings. So to make sure we're on the same page here, I threw up a definition in which we were operating under when we're talking about feeding practices in our study. So feeding practices in this study was simply the ways in which parents feed their children, including the well-known restriction or pressure to eat practices that have been made famous by Dr. Birch. So because of the limited research also on parent feeding practices with siblings, we were interested in finding out more about just how they perceive feeding behaviors or their feeding practices with siblings. And so to take a step back, we wanted to do a qualitative snapshot of this in order to get a sense of what parents are thinking about this. And then also interesting is how parents respond if siblings have differing characteristics such as weight status. So putting these two variables constructs together, we wanted to look at what would happen if we looked at sibling eating behaviors as well as parent feeding practices. So diving back into previous literature, we knew there wasn't much on parent feeding practices with siblings, especially qualitative research. But if you look back into the research with one child, there is some literature to go on. So we know from prior studies that parent restriction has been found to be associated with increased overweight in children in, across most age groups. There's less literature in preschool children, but in general we have a sense that parent restriction is associated with increased overweight with children. Pressure to eat, there is a little less evidence, but there's evidence to show that more disordered eating behaviors are likely when parents use pressure to eat feeding practices with children. So given that we knew this existed with the literature around one child, wanting to investigate a bit more about what this looks like if there's two children in the household. So this brought us to the purpose of our study. We wanted to, first of all, look into how parents describe their approach to feeding siblings in general. So what do they do or think about when they approach more than one child in the household, and what might they be thinking of? Also, with that, do they engage in different feeding practices with siblings or similar feeding practices with siblings? And then a step further, wanting to look at if they engage in different feeding practices based on child-specific characteristics, such as weight status, picky eating, and some of these demographic characteristics, such as age or sex, and potentially even temperament. So to do that, we used our data from our Family Meals Live study. And I want to give you just a little bit of background on this study as we move forward to explain how this current study came to be, the paper we're talking about today. So the Family Meals Live study is a funded study from NIH, the R21 study, that allowed us to do some mixed methods research, and this is a cross-sectional look at families through direct observational methods. So we went into families' homes to gather objective data. So as you can see here, we did two in-home visits, and during these in-home visits, we collected several things. One is video recorded family meals, and so across an 8-day observation period, families had the responsibility to video record their meals. So this was used, how they did this is they had iPads that were provided by the study so that they themselves could do it, and there was not a staff member, a research staff member in the home to do that, but they themselves did it, and then their data is what we then would get, and we coded it. It's an interesting part of the study, but that's not what we're talking about today, but we wanted you to have the context of the home environment, the experience the participants were having in the home environment when we conducted the study. They also had a home food inventory where we looked in cupboards and fridges and other places that families would keep food. also did dietary recalls, three-day, 24-hour dietary recalls on the child. There was a survey, and then the qualitative interview is what we will be talking about more in depth today. So this is the context in which the families were participating in the study. To give you a sense of our sample, we had 120 families that were participating in this study, and they're from our majority of them were from low-income and minority households, and they were recruited through primary care clinics throughout the Twin Cities, which is connected to the department that I work with. We also intentionally stratified these households by weight status of the child, so we had 60 from non-overweight houses and 60 from overweight children that were living in these households. So we were able to look at households where they might be engaging in feeding practices or meal practices where the children were meeting the less than 85th percentile and households in which they were over the 85th percentile. And then our age makeup here is between 6 to 8 and 9 to 12. As you can see, our sample was racially and ethnically diverse, and our households were in the low income ranges, and our parents were around 34 years, and we had a high percentage that were single parents homes. I will now pass to Amanda to introduce the study that this particular data is from.
Hi everyone, this is Amanda, and Jerrica just went over our Family Meals Live study. And the study that we're talking about today, we had an ancillary study to that Family Meals Live, and it's called the Family Meals Live Sibling Edition. We completed this a year after the Family Meals Live study was done. So a year after that was done, we followed up with the same exact families. This was about siblings, so we wanted to investigate how parents fed children in the home or siblings in the home differently or similarly. Of the original 120 families from Family Meals Live, 88 of them had siblings in the home and participated in this follow-up study. So you'll see that below, the methods on the bottom part of the screen, it talks about what we did with the families. We had about a 1 to 2 hour visit with the families where we went into their home. We took heights and weights of everyone in the family. We had the primary guardian or the main parent fill out a quantitative survey. And we also completed a semi-structured qualitative interview with that primary guardian. I'll mention that the demographic characteristics of the Family Meals Live Sibling Edition study were similar to the parent study, the parent Family Meals Live study. So again, this is a low income and minority population that we were working with. I wanted to give a little more information about the qualitative interviews. As I mentioned, this is a semi-structured interview. That means that the trained interview staff went in with a list of questions that we wanted to get answers to. However, they were trained to have follow-up questions or use probes to get more full answers, or if we felt like the participant wasn't giving the exact, not the exact answer, but wasn't really answering our question, we were trained to use these follow-up questions to get a more full picture of their home and how they fed their families. For this study, these are the interview questions that we drew from. You'll see the first one, how do you decide what to feed your children? The second, with regard to feeding your children, how do you feed them both similarly and how do you feed them differently? And then the following one is, how do you respond to situations where maybe one child is pickier than the other, maybe one child is at a greater or lesser weight than the other? So we are trying to get at, how do you feed them differently based on different characteristics of the child? I wanted to give some information about our coding process. So we had 88 interviews, and we coded all 88 interviews. For this study, we used a hybrid content analysis process. So we used both a deductive and an inductive approach. So we took the research questions and the interview questions that we used, and we used them to make an initial coding tree. So, for example, we might say we knew we wanted a theme of how do parents feed their children differently based on weight. So we plugged that in, and that was an initial theme in our coding tree. However, as we read the interviews, more and more themes arose out of these interviews. And so we would add themes as they arose from each individual interview. And that was our inductive process. So deductive was already having the coding tree established based on what we knew we were asking, and then inductive were the themes that just were naturally arising. We used in vivo to code. So this was coded by two research staff members that are trained in qualitative coding. The bottom part of the screen, it talks about our iterator reliability process. Each of the two main coders, we coded 20 interviews together. And so we made sure that we were consensing after each interview, made sure that we were seeing the same themes, and we also discussed any themes that we saw that arose that weren't part of that initial deductive coding tree. After we established reliability using those first 20 transcripts, coders coded every fifth interview together, and we had consensus meetings for those fifth interviews. We'd go through them and make sure that we agreed 100% on the themes for those fifth interviews, and we also discussed any themes that we saw to see if they were ones that we wanted to add to the coding tree or if they made sense in a different theme. For this study, we needed families to endorse a theme at least 33% of the time, meaning we needed at least about a third of the parents to endorse a theme to have it included in the paper. So there are times where maybe one to two families said something, said a response that was a unique theme, but it just wasn't endorsed enough that 33% of the time for it to be included in this paper. I wanted to remind everyone again before we went into the results section what our research questions were. So again, how do parents describe their approach to feeding siblings? How do they engage in different feeding practices with siblings in the home? And then do parents engage in different feeding practices based on child-specific characteristics like weight status, picky eating, developmental stage, etc.? We're going to move into the results section now, and Jerrica will lead this.
Thank you. So for the results, we are going to be presenting them by research question, and to keep track of the themes with qualitative research, it can be difficult. So we try to do some things visually to help keep track that you will see. So we will present the research question, and then we'll go through the themes. And within certain themes, there are also sub-themes. So we'll try to make sure that we're tracking those as we go to be as clear as possible. So for our first question of how parents describe their approach to feeding siblings, the first theme was that there was based on basically sibling food preferences. So parents decided that whatever the children said, they would go by. So in this quote, we're seeing that the mom will basically just ask, what are you guys feeling like for dinner? And what would you like me to pick up at the grocery store? So it was really based on what the children wanted to eat. And again, as far as when parents were responding, they were talking about more than one child in the home, so siblings specifically. The second theme that fell under the decisions to how parents decided to feed siblings is that they described doing planned meals. So here in this quote, you can see that the mom's describing that she picks out a meal that they're going to have the night before, and then they shop for what they need, so kind of a planned process here, and cook it, and then she doesn't have any complaints. And her summary here is that she thinks it's because they all like the same things. So she plans the meal as how she decides how to feed siblings. The sub-theme that fell under decisions about how to feed siblings is that parents decided what to feed siblings based on in-the-moment decisions. So in this quote, you can see that the parent is saying that they just don't decide whatever, I mean, the mood to cook or what's at home, she will decide. And even the question of what do you all want will come up. So the parent in this theme went through either the kids' food preferences, or decided to have a planned meal or make in-the-moment decisions. So those are the sub-themes under theme one.
Great. So the second theme on how do parents describe their approach to feeding siblings was about using three different types of food control with these siblings. The first is pressure to eat. And so that's where the parent either pressures the child or the sibling to eat either a specific food. So you'll see in the example here, the parent is really pressuring the children to drink milk. Or it's also where they're pressuring them just to eat more food. And so if they felt like they didn't have enough or they're kind of a fussy eater, just pressuring them to eat more and more until the parent feels satisfied that it's a good enough amount. Restriction is the second way that parents responded to or showed using food control with siblings. So about a third of the parents said they use restriction. It's a sort of opposite of pressure to eat. It's restricting kids or the siblings based on either a specific food. So you'll see here that she's restricting their sugared cereal or their Frosted Flakes to just the weekend. Other parents also discussed restricting the amount of food. So if they felt like their child was eating too much, then they would restrict just the amount that they would have. And then the third way was providing opportunities for healthful eating. And this was a unique theme that we found that isn't often seen along with pressure to eat and restriction. About a fourth of the families talked about not pressuring their kids to eat, not restricting what their kids eat, but instead having opportunities for the kids to have helpful foods or just having healthy foods at the meals. You'll see here that the mom talks about having, you know, vegetables or salads and just having it available but not necessarily pressuring their kid to eat that or restricting them from eating unhealthy foods.
All right, so moving on here, still under the research question of how do parents describe their approach to feeding siblings, we found a third theme, which was managing picky eating. So as they talked about their approach to feeding siblings, the picky eating topic came up, which is not too much of a surprise. So how did they actually manage the picky eating? So the first sub-theme that we found under that was that parents said they would cook only one meal. And so a mom here in this quote is talking about, we just eat the same thing. And that in the past they used to make different meals, it became too stressful, and she doesn't do that anymore. So she wants to put limits on not having the five different meals that she's talking about here. The second sub-theme under managing picky eating of siblings is that they would give some leeway to the meal. So here the mom is talking about allowing them to try it or take a few bites, five or six bites, in order to have them still eat it, but yet have a say in what they are or are not eating. So we're now going to move on to the next question. So just to summarize that first research question of how parents describe their approach to feeding practices, we found these three themes, and then within them several sub-themes.
Great. So the next research question we just want to go over is, do parents engage in different feeding practices with two siblings? And the first theme that we want to go over is that, yes, parents did endorse feeding siblings differently. Later we'll go into some of the reasons that parents reported feeding their siblings differently or the reasons why, but we did have more than half of the parents that said that, yes, they have two siblings in the home or more siblings and that they think they use a different approach in feeding them, you know, one from the other. And then the second theme, as you might imagine, is how do they endorse feeding siblings similarly. So they didn't look at the kids and say, oh, one has this personality or one has this weight status. They just looked at having these kids and saying, I just do it one way and I don't feed them differently. I just use one approach for feeding my children.
Okay, so then to summarize this piece, our research question of parents engaging in different feeding practices, we did find some that were talking about some different ways in which they fed them and some similar ways in which they fed them. So that was the second research question. So moving on to the third research question, we were looking again here, as we were saying earlier, about child characteristics. So really wanting to dig into their specific reasons why parents may or may not feed their children similarly or differently. So this first one, do parents engage in different feeding practices based on child characteristics? We found that parents would adjust their parent feeding practices based on sibling weight status. So an example here of a sub-theme was that restriction and portion control was occurring. So you'd see quotes like this one where a parent would describe the one sibling versus the other sibling that they need to control, you know, like cut down one versus the other one. And that some of the results from this is that people, you know, they get really mad, and but I worry about her weight. So parents feeling that push and pull of what to do when children have these two different characteristics. So when one is not overweight and the other is overweight. So really trying to know how to respond to it. In these cases, they said that they would use restriction and portion control. The second one was that parents responded by using pressure to eat parent feeding practices. So again, here you'll notice that parents are describing one or the other sibling in a certain way. So talking about one that's tiny, telling them to eat more, drink more milk, you're tall and you'll grow more, pressuring that one who was not, that was normal weight or not overweight, to eat more.
So Jerrica just talked about how parents responded that they did adjust their parent feeding practices based on sibling weight status. And then the second theme was that parents said that, no, they don't adjust their parent feeding practices based on weight status. And this could mean two things. It could mean the parents didn't see that their child's weight was a problem, that they didn't feel that they needed to adjust. But even sometimes, if you look at the quote, it's, if one was bigger than the other, and I feel that she eats too much, you know, I wouldn't say nothing to her or feed her differently. And so parents who also reported maybe seeing a differential weight in their siblings, they felt like it wasn't appropriate to adjust how they fed their child because one child was larger or a smaller size than the other.
Okay, and then the third theme, again, under this question of whether parents adjusted feeding practices based on child characteristics, was that parents said that they would adjust their feeding practices according to the age or developmental stage of the child. So in this case here, our mom is saying, I give them all portions that I know will match their age. And so that was the way in which a mother would decide how they would feed their child. And again, it was mostly on this more developmental approach for the children.
So those were the results to our study, and we feel like there's a lot of strengths to this study, mostly that we have so many that we were able to look at with siblings. We had 88 interviews to code, but we also think there are some limitations that need to be considered. One is that the majority of the primary guardian or the main parent were mothers, and that was just the person who identified being the primary guardian, so we didn't get a lot of father's perspectives or even maybe like a grandfather or a grandmother perspective. And also, we do feel that it was a strength that we had a low-income and minority population. However, there were some groups such as Latinos or American Indians which were underrepresented in our population, and so these would be really interesting questions to ask across different, maybe different income levels, but mostly across different race ethnicities to see if we are finding similar patterns.
Okay, so now I wanted to spend some time here talking about implications, and what we'll do on this slide is we have several bullet points, and we'll tag team a bit here if Amanda has some that she wants to add to bullet points as we kind of talk through this slide here. So one of the, I think, the take-homes from this paper was that, you know, a lot of the things that we've seen with the research that's on single children around pressuring to eat and restriction, that those are the things that were still coming up in relationship to having two siblings or more than one child in the home. So the first kind of talking point that I wanted to take from that is that the interventions and clinical practices, whether it's primary care, pediatrics, where they see, they're potentially more likely to see siblings, and where, you know, parents bring in multiple children, thinking about how they would consider the way in which parents tailor feeding practices. And then this, in particular, there's, you know, child characteristics, and here we're talking specifically about weight status. So the practices that I work in, so my appointment, as we were hearing earlier, is that I'm in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health, and so part of my appointment is to do clinical work in a primary care setting in which we have, you know, parents bringing in their children for well-child visits. And we will get time after time questions around how, you know, feeding their children, especially as they've been heightened to this, you know, obesity difficulty and problem in social media. You know, parents will come in and say, well, so what should I do? And oftentimes we knew, again, what the literature says about one child, but not so much about multiple children. And in the case where the primary care setting in which I work, there is often, you know, multiple children. So this is, again, another one of the reasons that was a bit of an inspiration of this paper, is because we don't know enough about what to do when there's more than one child in the household and how even parents perceive that. So the first take home is really like thinking about just first steps in that. I mean, clearly this wasn't a quantitative paper where we found associations between this and that, but it's leading to us to believe that there potentially will be those types of associations, and clearly we need to do that for the research. But being able to have first step is just conversations with parents around how they perceive that they parent, you know, one or two children or three or four children in the household, and what they think about their parent feeding practices in regards to multiple children. And so one of the implications for primary care, for instance, or pediatrics, would be during those well-child visits when the families are coming in and they're already asking about the types of foods the children are eating, to have an open-ended question around, you know, since there's multiple children in the household, I'm curious about how you think you feed your children similarly or differently. So just a basic open-ended question around how parents themselves perceive that they feed their children and multiple children in their household. And to really bring that into the context in the room, the relationships about with the other children in the home, and how that would, the parent perceives that that may influence how they feed children.
The second implication that we have here is that future research should examine if providing opportunities for healthful eating is a new type of feeding practice. So you'll remember that the first research question, we talked about three different strategies that parents use to feed their children. One was pressuring to eat. The second was restricting their child. And the third was providing opportunities for healthful eating. And this was a way that parents tried to feed their siblings without trying to pressuring them to eat or without trying to restrict what they ate. It's not something that we often see along with pressuring to eat and restriction, this sort of covert way of feeding their children. And also, we noticed that parents, when they said that they were restricting or pressuring to eat, that it wasn't because they were trying to be mean or they were just trying to really isolate that one maybe overweight or underweight child. It was out of concern for their child most of the time, that they were just trying to help their child. And so it would just be interesting to know more about if parents are doing this, if they see this as their strategy, if it's a strategy that parents use because they're trying to help a child that they perceive to be either underweight or overweight, and just more exploration about if just serving healthy food is the best strategy at the meal to help an underweight or an overweight child, just if that could be a way that we could talk to parents about just providing the opportunities rather than doing the pressuring and the restricting to eat, which we know is harmful for kids.
So in connection with that, since this is a newer finding, at least in the qualitative literature, we would need to explore whether this also is specific to having siblings or if this would also show up just with research with one child. So is there something particular about having more than one child in the home that you're more likely to provide opportunities for healthy eating, or is it again its own type of feeding practice that would exist without this backdrop of siblings per se? So the suggestion is that this is potentially an important feeding practice to take into consideration, establishing that it whether it's sibling-specific or not sibling-specific. The other thing I was, again, trying to overlay with clinical practice is that often this is an actual kind of feeding practice I've not heard parents talk about when they come in for well-child visits. And to give a little more context to this, you might be wondering why a behavioral health person is doing well-child visits. So just to give a little context on this, the clinic that I work in, we do integrated care, which is where, you know, we still have our MD doctors that will go in and see children in well-child visits. But we have specific kind of clinical pathways is what we call them, and they're literally just like triggers in or cues that prompt the behavioral health person to also accompany the doctor, the primary care doctor, into the visit. So our behavioral health people are from licensures such as, you know, psychology, family therapists, social workers, etc. And so on certain visits, they would then accompany the doctors. And so on well-child visits in the clinic that I work in, we do that. And so around obesity prevention, we'll go in. Around feeding practices, we'll go in. And so this is kind of, again, a pathway in which potentially we'd be able to get more the tailored approaches to being able to talk about feeding practices with parents so that there's the behavioral health person. We also have a dietitian in our clinics as part of the integrated care practices that will get pulled in for these types of visits. And I haven't, as I was saying, I haven't necessarily heard people talking about providing opportunities for healthful eating. But again, like, were we asking the right questions? Wondering if we're missing that occurring, or that we know in what ways to ask questions to find out if this type of feeding practice is occurring. So measurement, there's lots of things around measurement that could occur and advance the field, as well as officially testing this in data that's either observational or survey-based data to see if these associations exist on a larger scale with larger populations.
The next implication, and I talked about this a little with our limitation section, is that it would be useful to examine how parents feed their siblings differently across different racial or ethnic groups. As you might recall, our population, it was the primary population we looked at was African American. We did not have a large number of Latino or American Indian. We had a small number of Asian families, or families that identified as Asian. And so this would be interesting to look at across these different racial ethnic groups who might have different feeding practice styles to see if they are able to look at one sibling different than the other, or if they just parent their children similarly like we saw some parents do. It also would be interesting to look at, depending on the number of siblings, that parents might be overwhelmed from the just effort of feeding multiple siblings or multiple family members, that they might not use different strategies because they're just not able to do it. Not that we're recommending that you use different strategies, but you might see a different based on household size as well.
So along with that is, we clearly realize that the next step in the research is you know, looking at the actual associations between some of the things that we found. The fact that we did see a lot of this language around, you know, pressuring and restriction, again, it would be important to take our findings and replicate it with a larger sample size. There have been, you know, some studies that have done this with sibling sets, but you can imagine that they pose their own challenges trying to recruit families in which they're siblings, and then being able to do measures with multiple children in the home and figuring out which siblings that would be, you know, the closest age sibling versus certain gendered sibling, or an age, you know, age or gender, or those types of questions, like how do you choose the sibling? So I realize there's lots of complicated issues with doing sibling research. So I realize that's why a lot of research hasn't been done with siblings. But our recommendation or suggestion for the, you know, how to move this forward with next steps is that taking the qualitative information that we found and the themes that we found and putting them into more of a quantitative type of approach, and whether it's survey data or objective data where you can code, you know, parent interaction at mealtimes, for instance, as we did in our parent study, you know, either way is a great next first step, but of course with a larger set of siblings to be able to look at associations between if these parent feeding practices are then associated potentially with more unhealthy weight or weight control behaviors.
This
All
is
right,
also, I was going to add that this is also why the providing opportunities for healthful eating is just an interesting topic to explore, because it's sort of a family level recommendation. And as of yet, it's not a recommendation. It's just something that came up as a theme. And so for parents that do have a concern about one sibling and maybe not a concern about the other siblings, these parents obviously are looking for strategies or are trying out different strategies in ways that they think are helpful, or they're trying to help that one sibling. And so it would be useful to be able to explore and have really family-based strategies that we can help parents learn and use with their family meals, and so that they don't feel like they're really isolating or punishing one sibling for being overweight or being underweight, and it's something that can just be positive for the whole family without singling any one sibling out.
The other thing that I'll mention about other practices, so clearly I have been focusing really on clinical, because that is the setting I work in, so primary care, pediatrics. However, clearly there's implications for other settings, such as WIC, Women, Infant, Children, centers in which parents work, or that providers work with parents around these issues would be another, you know, key place that this type of research could be implemented for next steps. And when I was saying earlier that even having the first step of a conversation with the parent around the types of feeding practices they have with their children is a good first step to just kind of get a sense of what parents are perceiving or thinking around, you know, having multiple children in the home, just because that tends to also be associated with higher stress levels of parents. So our last implication here is that this might speak to some opportunities that we would teach parents about how to use alternative feeding practices with children. So what are some things you could do instead of using the controlling feeding practices, restriction and pressure to eat, that tended to come up a lot as far as the theme? So even though we found the theme of providing opportunities for healthful eating as an potential third type of feeding practice, it wasn't as endorsed as often, you know, as the other two. So it could speak to the idea that we want to teach these, you know, parents other types of feeding practices besides the pressure and restriction, which seems to kind of be the most common language or descriptions that we heard that we're the ones who labeled it pressure or restriction. They didn't say those words, but as they were describing it, that they were what they were talking about fell into those two categories of pressure to eat and restriction more so than the providing opportunities. So it may be speaking to the need for even thinking further about how to do that when it comes to siblings. So again, clearly we can't make a recommendation yet, but it's a type of a thoughtful next step to think about that would potentially be the case for working with parents around siblings and feeding practices. So then that we are now, I think our official, that was our last slide, right, Amanda? Let's see.
It was.
This is our last slide as far as implications for research and practice. So we are open to be able to take questions at this point, and I know Ginger was going to come in and moderate, so let's see what she has at this point.
Great. Thank you both for a wonderful presentation. We do have a number of questions from people listening in. So either one of you could, you know, chime in and answer them. One of the first questions we have regards the exclusion of certain individuals. Their question is, does requiring one-third of parents to endorse the theme force the exclusion of unique findings or cases that are perhaps more relevant to contribute to literature? I don't know if either one of you have some thoughts on that.
Sure. So what we try to do with this is kind of follow best practices with qualitative research, which is there's not a hard fast rule on what percent should be or not included. It's just that what tends to happen is, at least with this study, there wasn't a ton that fell underneath that, but you know, a theme that only included like one or two families, it's hard to state that that is, you know, truly a theme when there's only like two or three families endorsing it. And so we followed the cutoff point of a recommendation. Some will say, you know, 25, a fourth, some will say a third, some will say don't cut it off, right? So I realize there's different camps around this, but in this situation it made sense with the the data that we had to put some kind of limit around really feeling like there was enough of a sample size to call it a theme. But potentially, yes, that is a limitation of the study.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you. And the next question is like a two-part question. Was there a criteria for deciding which child among the siblings was used for stratifying based on weight status? And how would you interpret the results in the case of a household where some but not all the siblings were overweight?
Can you say the very first part again?
Sure. Maybe just the first question. Was there any criteria for deciding which child among the siblings was used for stratifying based on weight status?
Okay.
Right. So we had the target child from the Family Meals Life study, so that was always our main child. And then when that child had multiple siblings in the home, we looked at siblings that were 2 to 18 years old. And so if there was a sibling that was much older, like a 22-year-old, we looked in the 2 to 18-year-old range. And then we looked at the closest age sibling to that target child. Occasionally there was the chance that the target child had a sibling both older and younger that was about equidistant, and in those cases we selected the older sibling. And so if there was a 6-year-old target child with a 3-year-old and a 9-year-old sibling, we took the 9-year-old and asked them to be the sibling for the study.
And some of that, again, was we were drawing on kind of the developmental literature of thinking who would have the most likely influence on the child. And so it's most likely an older sibling that would influence in that case. And so that's why that was chosen. And when Manda was saying that the cutoff was 18, that means we would exclude people. That's why the total 88 is what we were left with for the sample, because there were some that had random siblings that were, you know, 21 or 20, and that was just, and they had to live in the home, so it was just so they could actually be influenced. The parent would actually feel like they were being influenced by those sibling eating behaviors or having an influence through their parent feeding practices on those children. So we had to cut it off that they were living in the home and under a certain age, that the parent would still kind of be perceiving themselves as feeding them. So that's how that got cut off. So the weight status then, how we stratified was based on the target child, the Family Meals Live kid, and then their closest age sibling. And then what we did was we then grouped those two, whether they were their weight statuses matched or did not match, so concordant or discordant. And that's how we figured out the question around if their weight statuses were different.
Okay, great. Thank you for clarifying. And then how would you interpret the results in the case of maybe a household where maybe some but not all the siblings were overweight?
Yeah.
It's
a great question. It's a great question. Kind of brings up the similar issues of, like, what do you do when you have multiple weight status children, right, in the household. So our results really obviously can't speak to that, but I think it just goes to show there's, like, a lot more we need to understand and learn about when it comes to households with multiple children and these different characteristics that each child could bring and how parents would adapt to that or not. Maybe when there's, you know, multiple children, then half are within a certain weight status and half are within the other. Does it, you know, equal itself out or cancel itself out? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think it's another really interesting one we would have to take time to do the research on. And, again, for those multiple reasons of how difficult it is to even do more than one child research with siblings and multiple siblings, it just doesn't often get done. But definitely an interesting one.
Yeah. And just to kind of follow up, there's so many different characteristics of a child. And one question was, how do you distinguish between feeding practices versus communication around feeding? So I'm sure there's, a different level of communication between the parents and the children. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about what you found when you had these interviews and focus groups with the parents.
So I guess I would ask Amanda if there was, when you were the coding, it didn't come up as a theme, right? So communication per se didn't come up as a theme. Is there anything you could speak to around that? Or?
So if I'm understanding the question, it's about do they talk to their, do they communicate a pressuring to eat, so you have to eat this, versus do they just maybe put more on their plate? Is that the question?
They were just curious as to how you might distinguish between feeding practices versus communication around feeding. They had some examples like motivational versus regulatory versus instrumental.
Mm.
If that even came up in the discussions. But.
Yeah, I think maybe the clarity of the question isn't to the point that the word maybe understanding it, but it sounds like, from what I can gather from it, is that, you know, what we were hearing is more of the pressure to eat and restriction versus like the instrumental types of things that parents would use, to the bribing or things like that. Those were just things that we did not hear much in the interviews about.
Great. Okay. And then another question is regards to the weight. Well, it relates somewhat to how the parents perceive the weight of the child. They were curious as to knowing whether you assessed parental perception of child's weight, and do you think that maybe influenced some of the responses? So I know that you had like the actual measured weight. But our parent perceptions of the weight or their weight concerns for the child, do you think that would have made a difference in some of the responses?
Right. So for this, I'm just looking back in the notes. For this, when we asked the parents, how do you feed them differently based on things like weight, they didn't have our objective measurements of that. And so that was based on what they felt the child's weight was, if they felt the child was underweight or overweight, and so, right, we didn't stratify this necessarily by the anthropometry we took in the home, but it was just based on what the parents were thinking the weight was, and if they felt like they were doing it based off their perception of the weight.
Okay. Gotcha. And so we have another question. The listener says, thank you for a great talk. They were wondering, since you have quantitative data, they were wondering if you were able to look at this, the qualitative data, together with what you have. So, for example, are the families that reported opportunities for healthy eating the ones that also have healthier food availability in the home? Maybe I read this wrong.
I was just wondering
if you were able to comment on that.
Yeah. So, great suggestion, and we are trying to use kind of our mixed methods data in a way that is actually mixed methods. That is true. For this specific study, we were kind of feeling like we were taking a first step in a bit of an unknown, and so we didn't do technically mixed methods throughout this paper. So obviously we had to use the quantitative data to, you know, stratify our kids to know if they were overweight or underweight, you know, households. But that wasn't necessarily how we used the data in this study, because we were trying to take that first step in understanding just parent feeding practices with two children, their perceptions of feeding, you know, two children. So we didn't actually use a mixed methods approach for this specific paper. We have done that with other papers in which we're trying to use what the data says and then quotes to match it, but not for this one specifically.
Okay, great. So another question, were there any associations between overweight status and providing opportunities for healthful eating theme?
So was there associations between...
If you were to just look at the, the overweight
status,
the children that are, providing opportunities for helpful eating theme.
Yeah. So we didn't look at that association. We didn't really take this to the next step of looking at any of the associations between what we found qualitatively reported and kid weight status. We have not done that.
Okay.
And some of it is that sample sizes get kind of small. And so we it's hard to look at that, but it's definitely an interesting next step. We could try to see if our sample sizes look like they could do that.
Now, did you see any differences, I guess, in your conversations or different interviews between how moms and dads responded to the children? Like, I'm just wondering if fathers might have responded differently to the questions versus the mother and the feeding practices for siblings.
That's a great question, and we did not take a look at that. As I mentioned, most of our the great majority of our responders were mothers, and so we have a really small sample that is fathers, but we didn't stratify by that to take a look at the difference. I believe it would probably be about eight or nine that were dads. So it would be something interesting to look at. I'm not sure we have the sample size, but we didn't look at that for the study.
Yeah. Now, has anything in the literature been done looking at that, differences between moms and dads? And I don't know if there has been anything in the literature besides maybe what you guys have done.
Yeah. Well, definitely not with siblings, but with the looking at feeding practices with one child, there may be. I'm not as familiar with the father literature regarding that parent feeding practices.
Okay, great. So another question: did you find that the first child's experience shaped the feeding of the second child? And so, for example, if a parent had, the first child being a picky eater, and they catered to their eating, did that influence how they fed the second child?
So I can only answer this, that wasn't a research question of this study. I can only answer it just from being one of the coders. And I don't have exact numbers here, but I would say that they did not. It didn't appear to carry over that with picky eating. It might have impacted the mood, and that impacted the whole family. That it was frustrating to parents, but for the most part, when children were really picky eaters, they might make a separate meal for that child, or sort of alter how that meal was made for that child, for the picky child, and it impact the sibling. Or they use different strategies to get just that child to eat. So they might say, you need to finish this to have dessert, or you have to try it, that sort of thing, where it didn't so much carry over to the other child, that it was just a strategy that they were using to get that kid to eat some food, or just make them a whole separate meal. That was not super common, but it wasn't, I would say, maybe a fourth of the parents who reported having a picky eater would say that they would just alter the meal or have a separate meal. So I would say there wasn't a ton of overlap where that non-picky eater was really affected.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. So we're actually running out of time, but we really appreciate both of you presenting today for us for our journal club. I'm going to let Rachel kind of close out today's session. So thank you again for a lovely presentation.
Yes, excellent. Thank you. Just a reminder, watch for a follow-up email. I'll try to get that out by the end of the day tomorrow with a link to the recording that we made, the slide handout, as well as your CEU certificate. And then we will be back for Journal Club next Monday on the 28th. I'll also kind of give you a heads up. The week of December 5, we have the last Journal Club webinar on Monday the 5th. We have a probiotics webinar on the 7th, which is actually open to non-members, so you can feel free to share that information. And then we have the skills building, picking the correct images webinar by the communications division on the 9th. So if you haven't registered for those yet and you're interested, please go to the SNEB website to do that. Thank you.